TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
Speak out. And a vast paranoia sweeps across the land, and America turns the attack on its twin towers into the beginning of the Third World War, the war with the Third World. And the terrorists in Washington are shipping out the young men to the killing fields again. And no one speaks. And they are rousting out all the ones with turbans, and they are flushing out all the strange immigrants. And they are shipping out all the young men to the killing fields again, and no one speaks. And when they come to round up all the great writers and poets and painters, the National Endowment of the Arts of Complacency will not speak. While all the young men will be killing all the young men in the killing fields again. So now is the time for you to speak, all you lovers of liberty, all you lovers of the pursuit of happiness, all you lovers and sleepers deep in your private dream. Now is the time for you to speak before they come for you, O silent majority.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti, in this moving appeal for peace that could have been written today, as Democrats and Republicans are calling for regime change, intervention, and war. Of course, the reference to 9/11 dates it. This poem was recorded in March 2003. It was the introduction to the TUC radio program on the Neoconservative Project for the New American Century. You may remember the circumstances. About 1 year after September 11, a blueprint for U.S. global dominance surfaced that named the countries to be invaded: Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and maybe also Iran and North Korea. The document also stated that the American people would never agree to such a military global dominance project unless there was an event that galvanized public opinion, such as a new Pearl Harbor. The document was called Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for a New American Century, and it was commissioned by Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and others in the year 2000, before any of them were in government. The think tank, the Project for the New American Century, produced this blueprint. The document remained secret until 2002, when it was discovered and published by the Scottish Sunday Herald. The Project for the New American Century, or PNAC, was founded in 1997 by William Crystal and Robert Kagan. To this day, prominent leaders in the neoconservative movement. PNAC was dissolved in 2006 and replaced with a Foreign Policy Initiative, also founded by William Crystal and Robert Kagan. In spite of what many of us see as the failure of the policies he recommended, Robert Kagan was appointed as an advisor by Hillary Clinton when she became Secretary of State. Clinton also hired Kagan's wife, Victoria Nuland, as her spokesperson. Nuland had previously served as a top aide to Vice President Cheney. Victoria Nuland, by her own admission, was personally involved in the recent regime change in Ukraine. In 2014, Robert Kagan told the New York Times that he hoped that his neoconservative views would prevail in a Hillary Clinton administration. "I feel comfortable with her on foreign policy," he said. In February 2016, Kagan gave Clinton his formal endorsement for president. On the last day of the Democratic Party convention, retired Marine General John Allen delivered a frightening and jingoistic endorsement of Hillary Clinton. In one of the most troubling moments at the convention, the shouts of "No more war" from Bernie Sanders supporters were drowned out by Hillary Clinton backers, who began shouting, "USA, USA." Here's a short clip of General Allen's endorsement of Clinton.
"I stand with you tonight, a retired four-star general of the United States Marine Corps. And I am joined by my fellow generals and admirals. They are here before you because this most consequential election is the greatest one in our memory for the President of the United States.
USA!
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 USA! We are the greatest country on this planet. So we stand before you tonight to endorse Hillary Clinton for the President of the United States of America. We know that she, as no other, knows how to use all instruments of American power to keep us all safe and free. We will lead and strengthen NATO and the Atlantic Alliance and our allies in East Asia and around the world, whom we have sworn a solemn oath to defend.
Marine General John Allen endorsing Hillary Clinton. In 2003, Ferlinghetti and friends were appalled that the media had not presented the text of the neoconservative agenda, rebuilding America's defenses. Now, over a decade later, that text, still relatively unknown, takes on new significance. You'll be able to tell in a moment how thoroughly the plans of 2000 were followed, and how deeply entrenched the neoconservative agenda has become as it permeates both Republican and Democratic leadership. R.G. Davis, founder of the San Francisco Meme Tube, is the reader of this important PNAC text.
You are listening to excerpts from Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for a New Century, produced by the Project for the New American Century. Key findings. This report proceeds from the belief that America should seek to preserve and extend its position of global leadership by maintaining the preeminence of U.S. military forces. Today, the United States has an unprecedented strategic opportunity. It faces no immediate great power challenge, and its political and economic principles are almost universally embraced. At no time in history has the international security order been as conducive to American interests and ideals. The challenge for the coming century is to preserve and enhance this American peace. Yet unless the United States maintains sufficient military strength, this opportunity will be lost. There are four essential missions. America's global leadership and its role as the guarantor of the current great power peace relies upon the safety of the American homeland. the preservation of a favorable balance of power in Europe, the Middle East and surrounding energy-producing regions, and East Asia. Large wars. The United States must retain sufficient forces able to rapidly deploy and win multiple simultaneous large-scale wars, and also to be able to respond to unanticipated contingencies in regions where it does not maintain forward-based forces. This resembles the two-war standard that has been the basis of U.S. force planning over the past decade. Constabulary duties. Third, the Pentagon must retain forces to preserve the current peace in ways that fall short of conducting major theater campaigns. Such forces must be expanded to meet the needs of the new long-term NATO mission in the Balkans, the continuing no-fly zone and other missions in Southwest Asia, and other missions in vital regions of East Asia. Current armed forces are ill-prepared to execute these missions. As the Joint Chiefs of Staff have admitted repeatedly in congressional testimony, they lack the forces necessary to meet the two-war benchmark as expressed in the war plans of the regional commander-in-chief. Forces for major theater wars. The one constant of Pentagon force planning through the past decade has been the recognized need to retain sufficient combat forces to fight and win as rapidly and decisively as possible multiple, nearly simultaneous major theater wars. In short, anything less than a clear two-war capacity threatens to devolve into a no-war strategy. Unfortunately, Defense Department thinking about this requirement was frozen in the early 1990s. To better judge forces needed for building an American peace, the Pentagon needs to begin to calculate the force necessary to protect independently U.S. interests in Europe, East Asia, and the Gulf at all times. Forces for constabulary duties, that is, local policing actions. In addition to improving the analysis needed to quantify the requirements for major theater wars, the Pentagon also must come to grips with the real requirements for constabulary missions. The 1997 Quadrennial Defense Review rightly acknowledged that these missions, which it dubbed smaller scale contingencies or SSCs, would be the frequent and unavoidable diet for U.S. armed forces for many years to come. Quote, based on recent experience and intelligence projections, the demand for SSC operations is expected to remain high over the next 15 to 20 years, unquote. Repositioning today's force. Despite the centrality of major theater wars in conventional force planning, it has become painfully obvious that U.S. forces have other vital roles to play in building an enduring American peace. It will be difficult, if not impossible, to sustain the role of global guarantor without a substantial overseas presence. Our allies, for whom regional problems are vital security interests, will come to doubt our willingness to defend their interests if U.S. forces withdraw into a fortress America. Equally important, our World Wide Web of alliances provides the most effective and efficient means for exercising American global leadership. The benefits far outweigh the burdens. Whether established in permanent bases or on rotational deployment, the operations of U.S. and allied forces abroad provide the first line of defense of what may be described as the American security parameter. Guarding the American security parameter today and tomorrow will require changes in U.S. deployments and installations overseas. In the Persian Gulf region, the presence of American forces along with British and French units has become a semi-permanent fact of life. Indeed, the United States has, for decades, sought to play a more prominent role in Gulf regional security. While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. The American armed forces stationed abroad and on rotational deployments around the world should be considered as the first line of American defenses. These forces need to be among the most ready, with finely honed warfighting skills, and only forces configured for combat indicate the true American commitment to our allies and their security interests. But they also need to be highly versatile and mobile with a broad range of capabilities. They are the cavalry on the new American frontier. The Persian Gulf and surrounding region has witnessed a geometric increase in the presence of U.S. armed forces, peaking above 500,000 troops during Operation Desert Storm, but rarely falling below 20,000 in the intervening years. Although Saudi domestic sensibilities demand that the forces based in the kingdom nominally remain rotational forces, it has become apparent that this is now a semi-permanent mission. With the rationalization of ground-based U.S. forces in the region, the demand for carrier presence in the region can be relaxed. As recent strikes against Iraq demonstrate, the preferred weapon for punitive raids is the cruise missile, supplemented by stealthy strike aircraft and long-range Air Force strike aircraft. East Asia. Current U.S. force planning calls for the stationing of approximately 100,000 U.S. troops in Asia, but this level reflects Pentagon inertia and the legacy of the Cold War more than serious thinking about current strategic requirements or defense needs. The prospect is that East Asia will become an increasingly important region marked by the rise of Chinese power. It is not too early to recognize that the presence of American forces in Korea serves a larger and longer-range strategic purpose. For the present, any reduction in capabilities of the current U.S. garrison on the peninsula should be unwise. If anything, there is a need to bolster them, especially with respect to their ability to defend against missile attacks and to limit the effects of North Korea's massive artillery capability. A similar rationale argues in favor of retaining substantial forces in Japan. In recent years, the stationing of large forces in Okinawa has become increasingly controversial in Japanese domestic politics. And while efforts to accommodate local sensibilities are warranted, it is essential to retain the capabilities U.S. forces in Okinawa represent. In Southeast Asia, American forces are too sparse to address rising security requirements. Since its withdrawal from the Philippines in 1992, the United States has not had a significant permanent military presence in Southeast Asia. Finally, the Southeast Asia region has long been an area of great interest to China, which clearly seeks to regain influence in the region. In recent years, China has gradually increased its presence and operations in the region. Raising U.S. military strength in East Asia is the key to coping with the rise of China to great power status. In Northeast Asia, the United States must maintain and tighten its ties with the Republic of Korea and Japan. In Southeast Asia, only the United States can reach out to regional powers like Australia, Indonesia, and Malaysia, and others. This will be a difficult task requiring sensitivity to diverse national sentiments. In sum, it is time to increase the presence of American forces in Southeast Asia. The United States should seek to establish a network of deployment bases, or forward operating bases, to increase the reach of current and future forces. Not only will such an approach improve the ability to project force to outlying regions, it will help circumvent the political, practical, and financial constraints on expanding the network of American bases overseas. Deployment bases. Currently, U.S. Southern Command the Pentagon's Regional Command for Latin America is moving to implement a plan for forward operating locations to make up for the loss of Howard Air Force Base in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal from Panama and the return of the Canal Zone. Indeed, sustaining effective counter-drug operations will be difficult after the loss of Howard until arrangements for the new locations are in place. To achieve full coverage of the region for counter-drug operations, the command plans to utilize airfields ranging from Puerto Rico to Ecuador. While it should be a clear U.S. policy that such bases are intended as a supplement to the current overseas base structure, they could also be seen as a precursor to an expanded structure. This might be attractive to skittish allies, as in the Persian Gulf region, where a similar system is in operation, for whom close ties with America provokes domestic political controversy. Air Force, toward a global first strike force. From the Gulf War to Operation Allied Force over Kosovo, the increasing sophistication of American air power, with its stealth aircraft, precision-guided munitions, all-weather and all-hours capabilities, and the professionalism of pilots, planners, and support crews, has allowed the Air Force to boast legitimately of its global reach, global power. On short notice, Air Force aircraft can attack virtually any target on Earth with great accuracy and virtual impunity. American air power has become a metaphor for, as well as the literal manifestation of, American military preeminence. One of the many tasks for the future is that the Air Force reevaluate the need for greater numbers of long-range systems. In some regions, the ability to operate from tactical airfields is increasingly problematic, and in others, notably East Asia, the theater is simply so vast that even tactical in-theater operations will require long-range capabilities. In sum, the Air Force is too small, especially its fleet of support aircraft, and poorly positioned to conduct sustained operations for maintaining American military preeminence. The Air Force needs to be restructured, repositioned, revitalized, and enlarged to assure continued global reach, global power. In particular, the Air Force should be redeployed to reflect the shifts in international politics. Independent expeditionary air wings containing a broad mix of aircraft should be based in Italy, southeastern Europe, central and perhaps eastern Turkey, the Persian Gulf, and Southeast Asia. But it is in East Asia that the Air Force must look to increase its capabilities and reach. The Air Force needs roughly to double its forces stationed in East Asia, preferably dispersing its bases in the south, as it has in the north, perhaps by stationing a wing in Philippines and Australia. As in Europe, Air Force operations in East Asia would be greatly enhanced by the ability to sustain long-range bomber operations out of Australia. New course for the Navy. The end of the Cold War leaves the U.S. Navy in a position of unchallenged supremacy on the high seas, a dominance surpassing that even of the British Navy in the 19th and early parts of the 20th century. With the remains of the Soviet fleet now largely rusting in port, the open oceans are America's, and the lines of communication open from the coasts of the United States to Europe, the Persian Gulf, and East Asia. Yet this very success calls the need for the current force structure into question. Further, the advance of precision strike technology may mean that naval force combatants, and especially the large deck aircraft carriers that are the Navy's capital ships, may not survive in the high technology wars of the coming decades. To meet the strategic need for naval power today, the Navy should be realigned and reconfigured along these lines. The Navy needs to reflect the gradual shift in the focus of American strategic concerns towards East Asia. A majority of the U.S. fleet, including two-thirds of all carrier battle groups, should be concentrated in the Pacific. Marine Corps, back to the future. For the better part of a century, the United States has maintained the largest complement of naval infantry in any nation. The U.S. Marine Corps, with a three-division structure mandated by law and with a strength of more than 170,000, is larger than all but a few land armies in the world. Its close relationship with the Navy, to say nothing of its own highly sophisticated Air Force, gives the Corps extraordinary mobility and combat power. This versatility, combined with a punishing deployment schedule, makes the Marine Corps a valuable tool for maintaining American global influence and military preeminence. Yet, while this large Marine Corps is uniquely valuable to a world power like the United States, it must be understood that the Corps fills but a niche in the overall capabilities needed for American military preeminence. The Corps lacks the sophisticated and sustainable land power capabilities of the Army, the high-performance precision strike capabilities of the Air Force, and, absent its partnership with the Navy, lacks firepower. Restoring the health of the Marine Corps will require purchases of badly needed new equipment and restoring the strength of the Corps to something near 200,000 Marines. In particular, the Marine Corps, like the Navy, must turn its focus on the requirements for operations in East Asia, including Southeast Asia. In many ways, this will be a back to the future for the mission of the Corps. To maintain its unique and valuable role, the Marine Corps should be expanded to permit the forward basing of 2nd Marine Expeditionary Units, MEUs, in East Asia. These MEUs should be based in Southeast Asia along with a repositioned Navy carrier battle group as described above.
You heard excerpts from a document by the Project for the New American Century. The reader was Meme Troop founder R.G. Davis. Poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti gave the introduction. Written in 2000, the document by the Project for the New American Century amounts to no less than a blueprint for U.S. military world rule. It was commissioned by Richard Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and others. Join us for part two of this two-part reading of the paper by the Project for the New American Century. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.